Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. One of the remarkable things about last night's Trump rally in Phoenix was how much the president felt compelled to defend himself as not a racist. He blamed the media for casting him as one in his responses to Charlottesville, but forget CNN, everyone from David Duke to his delight to Paul Ryan to his dismay had heard the president as winking at white supremacy in a way he couched his remarks in the way he couched his remarks last week. Last night, the president begged and begged to differ.
So I'm condemning the strongest possible terms, egregious display, hatred, bigotry, and violence. Okay, I think you can't do much about it, right? Okay, but they didn't want to put this on. They had it on initially, but then when they talked, he didn't say it fast enough. He didn't do it on time. Why did it take a day? He must be a racist.
Now, our next guest knows white supremacy from the inside out. Derek Black grew up in Florida as the son of white nationalist leaders. David Duke is his godfather. Derek remembers driving a pickup truck with a Confederate flag sticker past Trump's Mar-a-Lago on his way to the beach. In college, Derek Black had a gradual change of heart and has since left and denounced the white nationalist movement. He's now a 27-year-old grad student in history. Maybe you saw his New York Times op-ed after Charlottesville, in which he said, "One particular statement by the president marked possibly the most important moment in the history of the white nationalist movement." It was these words.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
And it was these words.
And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay?
With me now is former white nationalist and history student, Derek Black. Derek, thanks so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate getting the chance to say a few words.
Let me start with why you saw that clip from the president's news conference last Tuesday as marking possibly the most important moment in the history of the white nationalist movement, as you put it.
The important thing to understand is that within the white nationalist movement, which has a lot of continuity over the last 30 or 40 years, the thing that defines it is how easy it is to condemn. Anytime there's a white nationalist rally, the organizers and everybody in attendance just takes for granted that every politician, local city council people up to governors and mayors and occasionally the president, are going to make a swift and very clear condemnation of the rally. And even if there's some overlap, even if they're anti-immigration, even if they're anti-immigration politician and the white nationalists are anti-immigration, they never, ever have any problem saying these people are advocating a bad agenda and I condemn them totally. So the first time in decades that an explicit white nationalist rally gets anything other than I condemn these people totally, it comes from the president. And it's a president who has been kind of encouraging and winking from a distance for months. And then when it finally comes down to actually what do you think of white nationalists standing in front of you, he just said, yeah, they have a good cause a little bit of the time. And that's enough to, I don't even know what could happen. It's enough to definitely spur recruitment to have that kind of acknowledgement.
You know what? The line we have is dropping in and out a little bit, and I want to fix it for our listeners. So hang on a minute. And I know you have another line we can call you back on, so we're going to do that. And then, listeners, as soon as we get Derek Black up, we're going to ask him about how, in the clip we played from last night in Phoenix, Trump defended himself as not a racist, repeating the transcripts of what he said at various points after Charlottesville, etc. And listeners, what do you want to ask Derek Black with his unique personal history and unique understanding of white nationalism in America? Or does anyone else want to tell a relevant personal story? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Derek, do we have you back? You there? Derek,
yeah,
you back?
Here.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
so as we were getting your other phone going, I was telling the listeners that I was going to ask you about Trump's speech last night in Phoenix, where he defended himself in the clip we played at the top as not a racist, repeating the transcripts of what he said at various points after Charlottesville, denouncing by name the Klan, neo-Nazis, white supremacies. Why does your godfather, David Duke, feel validated by him then?
I wouldn't say that I think that Trump is an advocate for white nationalism. The big deal is that, unlike everybody else in politics, he sees a very clear white nationalist rally and then doesn't condemn it. And that's really enough. I mean, that's what is so encouraging to white nationalist leaders, that none of them really think that he is ideologically 100% on their side. It's something about his swinging from the hip sort of style and his anti-establishment thing that he is able to look at their rally and then say that he sort of agrees at least with their stated reason for having the rally. And that's enough to be extremely encouraging, since you've had decades and decades of nothing but clear condemnation and working against the establishment. It's this breath of fresh air that, okay, somebody in the highest levels is able to look at it and say that's acceptable. And if you're somebody who's on the edge and thinking, maybe this move, I sort of agree with a lot of the things of this movement, but it's so extreme, having the president say what they're doing is at least in some ways okay could easily be enough to say, okay, fine, I'll join. You know, this is not fringe. This is the president's kind of saying it's all right.
You make a big point in both your New York Times op-eds, the one you wrote last week after Charlottesville and the one you wrote in November just after the election, of saying that when you were a white nationalist, you couldn't understand why anyone would fear you. You were only doing what you felt was right and defending those you loved. Can you elaborate on that mindset a bit for us and describe how white nationalists see themselves more in this regard?
Sure. The feeling within the movement is that you are the only group in modern day life that understands what a critical threat white people being a minority in America is to white people, and how important race is, and how really the science proves that race is the biggest separator between people, and that what race you are will predict how likely you are to commit a crime and your IQ and all of these biological things, and that it's a very real thing, and that we, as a culture, have adopted this political correct multicultural stance, and that is going to lead to white people being a minority, and that is going to lead to the destruction of the culture you love and the West, and it just spirals into conspiracy theories. But it's a small group. Everybody knows each other. And there's the feeling that you're the only people in the world who are going to do anything about this. And the argument goes that separating everybody is not racist, because you're not saying that you want to be supreme over anyone. You're just saying you want to separate every race in the world into separate nations. And then everybody can go live out their lives and be in their little monoracial utopias. And I have to stress, like, saying that and living as I do now, it completely sounds delusional. But this is a belief system that lots of people within this marginal movement believe, and they don't necessarily have to believe that they're doing anything bad. They can really believe that what they're doing is best for everyone and maybe try not to think about the ramifications of actually trying to push this agenda of anyone who's not white doesn't belong here. Because you never have to deal with that consequence if you're just organizing in a pretty small movement and having rallies and constantly up against the mainstream and the establishment. And it is white supremacy, but a lot of people within the movement don't think that they're advocating white supremacy.
George in Westchester, you're on WNYC with former white nationalist Derek Buck.
To ask the gentleman whether he felt that it was difficult for him to break away from what he heard at home. I think he said David Duke was his uncle or cousin or something.
His godfather.
Okay. And I'm sure when they got together to have family outings and this and that, you know, race would come up and, you know, the superiority of the white man and all that. And I only say that to say because I was watching Rachel Maddow the other night, and she made a statement that Fred Trump, this guy's father, was arrested in New York because he was marching with the KKK. I guess it was a disturbance. So apparently he was exposed as a young man, maybe around the dinner table. Friends got together, and they talked about, you know, the culture, the Confederacy, the greatness of being a white nationalist. So how difficult is it for someone who grows up in that situation to really be, you know, something other than what he's been exposed to?
How difficult was it for you?
It was super difficult because it was not just a belief system. It's not like people who have come into it when they're older. I grew up with it, and it was my family's connections. It was how my family bonded, was going to white nationalist conferences and hearing people speak. This sense of trying to fix the world by advocating this stuff was the shared purpose. And so when I came to a point, it was quite a long time, it was with a couple of specific people talking about these things and dismantling the ideology. And when I came to a point where I said, this is not only wrong, I was wrong, but it's damaging the world that I'm advocating this. One of the really toughest things was saying that my family is still doing it and I can't be a part of it. And in a lot of ways, it destroyed the connection with my family. So, that's the hardest thing.
That's
and I think there's a level of that in the wider white nationalist movement. It's a community. People know each other. They feel like they're in a common bond. And you don't just have to convince people that racism is bad. You also have to convince them that this community and shared purpose they're a part of is also bad. Mm.
What did change your mind?
It was bit by bit. Mine was sort of academic-y because I was a major white nationalist advocate, and I thought the best way to do that, growing up, I thought the best way to do that was to have good arguments. And so I tried to come up with those arguments based on IQ differences and criminality. And those things, if you're actually willing to listen, are very easily disproven. IQ differences do show up in race in America, but they're easily disproven based on natal nutrition and education levels and poverty and criminality is very easily explained in this way. Like race dick things, if you're willing to listen to what all of science says now, and because I was advocating things, trying to be very rational and logical, bit by bit, each of my arguments didn't work, and I had to pull them out of my toolbox until eventually this whole argument doesn't work, and then all I'm left with is the ramifications of advocating this are hurting tons of people, and how do I deal with that?
Geraldine in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hi. I read the article in the Washington Post about how you went to college and took history classes and ended up having Friday night dinners with a multicultural group of students. And I'm just wondering, you know, in terms of what the previous caller asked also, how much do you think education and your education can help communities in changing their minds at a base level?
I think it's important. I mean, obviously, education is very important. In my context, it was being in a college community and being in a space where I could talk to somebody else who would listen to what my arguments were and then not just shout me down, but try to come up with why is this wrong. But I also think it's very important that purely college and education is not what did it. Going to class, I could have very easily come out a white nationalist, even if the professors were making good arguments. What was really important was the personal relationships with people I trusted, who weren't going to just straight up condemn me and tell me to get out of their face. But we could go into, you know, a quiet room and back of a dorm and actually talk about this. And they would say, why do you believe this? And I would explain why I believe this. And then we'd meet again next week and they'd say, okay, I've read a lot about this and this really doesn't work as a belief system. And here's the repercussions of it. And it was that personal relationship that somebody was willing to listen to me. And I do have one last thing to say on that, is that I don't want people to take my story as, oh, we should just listen to white nationalists, you know, we shouldn't shout them down, because there's a time for talking, and, you know, the Charlottesville rally is not the time where you should say, oh, you know, we just need to listen, you should counter-protest, too. So it's complicated, but really in my case it was access education and the ability to access somebody who I trusted and respected who would listen to me and I would listen to them.
Gerilyn, thanks for your call. When you were driving that truck with the Confederate flag sticker as a teenager, what did the Confederate flag mean to you?
Purely Southern pride. That's what I thought anyway. Most of my family originally comes from the South, and I have all these Confederate soldier ancestors that people remember. And I would go to country concerts and everybody would have Confederate flags. It felt like an innocuous symbol. It felt like, why would anybody be offended by this? It's in the past history. It's just a cultural thing. And now I look back on it and I see the reasons. I see the Confederacy is a thing founded on white supremacy. But I can also see people, especially in the South, who say, no, it's this knee-jerk cultural thing. And that is a lot more complicated than explicit white nationalism. Trying to convince people that the Confederacy represents a white supremacist, explicitly white supremacist government, and that's why people of color might not like having Robert E. Lee statues at the town hall is important. But that is a tough conversation I think we can have. Really, right now with Trump, I'm just trying to get people to realize that white nationalism has to be cut off. You know, we can have the Confederate Memorial debate afterwards.
Well, to those who want to take down Confederate flags and other memorials because they stand for treason and slavery and don't see that as very complicated, is there something we don't get that is more complicated?
I mean, it's that people grow up seeing Confederate memorials and Confederate flags, and they legitimately think it's a cultural thing. They don't see it from the perspective of black people who say this is the slave government, you know, that you are championing. What does that mean
right.
for now?
But when you say
and
cultural, I hear that answer.
You know, I think you can convince people. It will take time, and I think it'll probably be like private conversations. I would say, personally, I think the fastest way in a lot of these towns, there's thousands of these statues if you ever travel to the South, I would say the fastest way to move forward, like tomorrow in some of these towns where taking the statue down is going to be very controversial, is to build a statue to a historical black leader right next to it. You know, that's something that's a lot harder for Southern people to argue against. You say you're going to take down history, they'll give you all this stuff about culture. You say, I'm going to build a statue of a historical black person right next to it. How do they argue against that without saying, revealing they're being kind of racist?
But take me one level deeper on it just having represented culture to you previously and to a lot of people still. What about Southern culture, other than slavery, does the Confederate flag represent? If they're saying culture and heritage and we scratch below that surface, it's so, to anybody, you know, you don't have to be black, to anybody who grew up in the North, it's, you know, it's the Confederacy, which was trying to break away for the state's rights to allow people to hold slaves. So is it something that you can articulate other than that to people?
I mean, at this point in my life, I come at it, and it's hard for me to differentiate my two perspectives, this, like, one being younger and being actively involved in white nationalism and now trying to dismantle the white advantage system in America today. And no, like, to real talk, there, it's white supremacy is so embedded in these visions of a noble Confederate South that you can't separate it. But that's also true for America. I wrote that op-ed this week, and I wanted to make the point that white nationalists really find common cause with a lot of the writings of the American founding fathers, who talk about how only white people can understand American liberties, and they black people have to be sent away back to Africa because we can't live together. And this is stuff that Thomas Jefferson's writing. And in the same way that we need to recognize that we can't just put up a Confederate memorial and say, oh, it doesn't represent the white supremacist parts, we also can't say American history is great without acknowledging that the thing is founded on white supremacy. I don't think that it's possible to end these white nationalist rallies and really cut them off at the root and cut the movement off at the root without acknowledging that this foundation that we're built on is white supremacist. And a lot of that exists in our society, and it comes from somewhere. And I think there's a common knee-jerk reaction to try to not look at it and not deal with it and not even know about it. And the people who want to build Confederate memorials, or at least not take them down, don't want to look at it. But this is a larger symptom in America. We don't really want to deal with this. And if we don't, white nationalists are going to be perfectly happy to throw it in our face and advocate it and say that they're the only people who are acknowledging what made America great. And we have to make this argument that that is not what makes America great.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Derek Black, who grew up in Florida as the son of white nationalist leaders. David Duke is his godfather. Derek remembers driving a pickup truck with a Confederate flag sticker past Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago on his way to the beach, for example, as a teenager. And Derek Black had a gradual change of heart and has since left and denounced the white nationalist movement. He's now a grad student in history, and maybe you saw his New York Times op-ed last week after Charlottesville, or one just after the election last November. Clay in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Derek Black. Hi, Clay.
Hi, Brian. Derek, thank you for your perspective. I really appreciate it. Throughout the last year and a half, the campaign, all of these things, we've heard a lot of talk of dog whistles. But they weren't. It was never really explained what those dog whistles were. I wonder if you could just go through some of what you hear in sort of everyday politics and talk about the overlap in policies and in ideas that seem innocuous to most of us, but are sort of messages out to the white nationalists and to the groups that that share those beliefs.
Sure. In my particular background is that I spent years trying to advocate for white nationalism and trying to look for messages that would have overlap with mainstream politicians. And those things, I ran this little Republican campaign in my county back in 2008. And the things that play well that are white nationalists and average people can get behind them are saying Mexican immigrants, illegal and legal, are rapists and that they're criminal and that they're going to change our culture. Another huge one is affirmative action is anti-white discrimination, saying that these programs keep out white people, that they're designed to keep white people out of university positions. Another one is to call the inner cities, which is always code for black neighborhoods, even though they're all black people do not live in the inner cities, to say that these places are dangerous, that they're not like us, and that these are all code for our country is going away from us. Our white 1950s country is different, and we need to do something about it. Another one is take our country back. These are the sort of things that you can say to a white nationalist rally, and you can also say to many Donald Trump rallies. Whether Donald Trump is actively trying to advocate for white nationalist groups, I never thought that was the case. It's just that there's this the same. And if you advocate these things, it helps white nationalists recruit and get bigger and feel more mainstream because these same things are being said on both ends.
And I think it was our next guest, Michelle Goldberg from Slate. Tell me if I'm confusing the two of you, because I read both your recent articles last night and this morning, but I think it was Michelle Goldberg from Slate who's coming on next, who said after Charlottesville, Trump went from dog whistles to a bullhorn. And so we'll talk about that with her.
Sure.
But do you think the legacy of Charlottesville, I mean, legacy, it's only, you know, 11 days ago, but still, Charlottesville and the nation's horror over the Friday night torch march and everything else is going to be to strengthen or weaken the white nationalist movement?
As of right now, it will be to strengthen it. Without Donald Trump's statement on Tuesday saying that they were good, there were good people there, I don't think it would have changed anything. But this really is an enormous moment. And whether that means the white nationalist movement gets super big, I have no idea exactly what will happen. But the point of that rally was to show that white nationalists can have a much bigger event than they've been able to have in the past, that it's public, and that if you agree with some of their statements that we shouldn't take down these statues and Confederate memorials and other white things, then they're your people. That was their goal, and Donald Trump essentially said they're right. And so anybody who was on the edge about joining will probably join now, and it's going to take time to see what the impact of that is.
My last
he needs to condemn it. He needs to go back and say, I've learned something new. they were all white nationalists. It's bad. You know, it's not too late. Please do that, Donald Trump.
So was last night in Phoenix progress toward that in a weird sort of way? I mean, because he got called out so much for winking at white nationalists, and maybe it was politically threatening to him to be seen that way, he made a big show last night of denouncing them and pulling out every passage in all of his post-Charlottesville remarks in which he did denounce them.
He didn't. As far as I've heard, that whole rally was a white nationalist rally, because it was. It was explicitly a white nationalist rally.
Yesterday,
some
last
people
night.
There. Yeah, as far as I heard, he retract that statement, that there were good people there and their cause was good. Mm. That's what he needs to say. And for whatever other politics, and I disagree with all of his politics, this explicit white nationalist ideology needs to be super clear that this is bad. You know, even if he has overlap with them, the organizations themselves can't be endorsed like that. It's just not too late. And I haven't heard everything that he said last night, but I don't think he's done that yet.
Derek Black grew up the son of leading white nationalists. David Duke is his godfather. Maybe you saw Derek's article in the New York Times last week after Charlottesville that recalls some of his path toward renouncing his family's ideology, and you've been hearing his elaborations today and on current events. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure this is really hard for you to do this in the context, you know, of your personal life and go publicly and get as specific and in people's, you know, in people's brains as much as you've done. So thank you for doing some of it here.
Thanks for having me on.